My talk is called, What Has My Compiler Done For Me Lately? Unbolting the Compiler's Lid, which is the longest and most complicated title I've seen. Titles, it turns out, are very hard. So why am I up here staring back at you all? It's definitely a question I'm asking myself at the moment. As Jason, in his wonderful introduction, has said, my name has rather unexpectedly become a noun and a verb, which has led to some extraordinarily surreal conversations this last week. I've not only had people come up to me and introduce themselves as if we're old friends, and I'm looking at them smiling, going, "Who are you?" And then they say, "Thank you for Compiler Explorer," which is amazing. Or I've been in conferences and people have been talking about Godbolt, and you know, like how there are those neurons in your brain that are always background process listening out for your own name, and I'm just looking around like this. So it's been very, very, very surreal. But so thank you for the very warm reception. But I'd like to talk a little bit about me, just so you know how it is that I came to come up with this idea for Compiler Explorer. So like a lot of people, I'm sure, I started a long time ago programming on these 8-bit computers here, which is, as Jason alluded to, still kind of a hobby of mine, still hacking around on the 6502 and the Z80. After a few years of trying to write my own games, that meant writing stuff in assembly, because that's the only way you could get anything done performantly back in those days, I moved over to the ARM processor. I sort of hung on to the 8-bit era rather too long, and then when the leap came, I made it all the way to 32-bit. And back in those days, there wasn't a version of GCC for my computer, so I was stuck still writing assembly code. I even ended up writing a whole IRC client in assembly, complete with windowing and scripting and everything built in, just because that was pretty much the only option open to me. So when I finally was introduced to C, I considered it a bit of a macro assembler. It was kind of like one of these things that was an annoyance. It got in the way of me writing the assembly that I wanted to write. But when I got to university and discovered that, oh, wow, suddenly it's very dark in here. Nobody falling asleep, right? When I got to university and realized that the only way that I could actually like write software that would run on more than just my one ARM computer that I had, I realized I had to learn C. And at that point, things moved on, and eventually C++ too. That led to me getting a job in the games industry where I spent 10 happy years, still kind of on the fence between writing assembly code and C code and maybe a bit of C++. After that, I had a dabble in writing C++ tools. So for those people who work on C++ tools, I have a huge amount of sympathy for you. The language is absolutely dreadful, and it's the worst thing to have to parse. So if you see anyone from like JetBrains or anything like that, give them a good firm handshake, or anyone from Eclipse. I then worked at a small internet startup, and then I moved on to DRW, which is the company I'm at now, where I do sort of low latency stuff. So you can sort of say I've always stayed pretty close to the metal. So what about this talk? It's an amazing opportunity to speak to so many C++ developers, and I thought to myself, what am I going to do with this time? What do I love? What do I want to tell people about? I love assembly. You probably realized that from the last few slides. So I want to make sure that you guys are happy and aren't scared at looking at assembly. It's a useful thing to do, and you should be doing it. Not all the time, and I'm not saying that you should go out and learn how to write assembly code or that you should even ever write assembly code, but you should be able to look at the output of your compiler and with some confidence know what it's doing. And when you do that, you'll appreciate how much work has gone into the compiler and how clever the compiler is. There's a lot of glamorous features that come out in the language, you know, all these new metaclasses, Herb's awesome metaclasses ideas, reflection is coming, and all the template metaprogramming tricks that you can do with the compiler. That's awesome, but that's all in the front end. It's very important as well that the code that comes out the other end, the thing that actually is going to run on the computer, is efficient. Well, first, is correct, and secondly, is about as efficient as it can be. So the outline of this talk is that I'm going to give you a little bit of a backstory as to how Compiler Explorer came about. I want to give you a very quick x86 assembly overview. I'm going to ask the question, what has my compiler done for me lately? Which is just to say, I'm going to look at some of the optimizations, some of the cool optimizations that compilers do. Now, of course, these are all going to be slide examples, so they're all totally contrived, but hopefully it'll whet your appetite for it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what happens when you type into my website, what's happening behind the scenes to give you your code results back in front of you. So in 2012, a friend and I were at work and we were discussing whether or not it would be possible for us to start turning on the C++ OX flag or the C++ 11 flag on the compiler and start using some of these new features that were coming through, you know, things like range fours, auto variables, things like that. And being a high-frequency trading shop, we can't just say to everyone, go ahead, you know, just use whatever cool new feature is available. We need to make sure that we haven't done any harm. So we concocted an example bit of code like this, which is, as you can see, it's just taking a vector by reference, vector of integers by reference, and it's just summing them all up. Yes, this could just be std accumulate, I know, but bear with me. And we wondered that this traditional way of writing it, that is just the looping over an iterator by using an index into that container, that would be how we'd write it before. We wondered whether or not we could replace it with the much nicer code here, just using, you know, range for. We'd been bitten before by other languages because some managed languages in particular that we had some experience with will construct iterators to, in order to iterate over a container like that. And that would generate garbage and ultimately things would go on behind the scenes. Obviously, C++ doesn't have garbage to worry about, but we just didn't know. We'd like to check, you know, we should test these things. So which one of these is better than the other? And that will be kind of like the leg into me talking about how Compiler Explorer came about. And if my clicker works, we'll go to the next one. So before I get into a whole bunch of assembly, we're going to sort of tell you, give you at least enough information to know about how to read assembly. I'm going to give you a big warning here. It's really beguiling to stare at the output of your compiler and start to kid yourself that you can see what it's doing and know instinctively that this is better than that or this other thing is best or like there are fewer instructions and so it must be faster, things like that. If any of you were in here before for Chandler's talk, he gave just a tiny glimmer of the kind of complicated things that are going on inside a modern processor, and you really can't predict. So while you can obviously develop an intuition about what's going on, you should always measure. You should definitely use something like Google Benchmark or one of the other benchmarking libraries that's out there that have done their best to try and make it as bulletproof as possible, although micro benchmarks have their own problem. Or you can, a quick shout out to Fred if he's in the audience somewhere, for his site, QuickBench, which is an awesome online tool that allows you to check out two different snippets and compare their performance, again, using Google Benchmark behind the scenes, but also in an interactive online way. And I clicked it down, whoops. So let's talk a little bit about x86. Well, first of all, I guess, how many of you compile for x86 platforms by raise of hands? Good. I had this terrible fear that suddenly everyone's gonna say, no, we do ARM now. All right, who does ARM? ARM predominantly. There's a few hands. What about 32-bit x86? Is that still being targeted? A smattering. Anyone got a more exotic processor that you regularly build for? Oh, yes, a PDP-11, right? All right, well, that gives me at least some legs. It would be really embarrassing now if suddenly I had to invent another another architecture to talk about, but we're going to talk about x86 and specifically x86-64. We don't need to know too much about it. All you need to know, it has registers. These are 64-bit values, and there are 16 of them. Back in the 32-bit version of the chip, there were only 8 of them with these funny names, AX, BX, CX, DX, and all these things. And some of them have like special meanings as well, but for the most part, you can think of them as general purpose, like variables. Luckily, when AMD decided to extend out to a 64-bit version, they added in 8 more registers, which was handy, and instead of inventing new funny names, they just called them the far more sensible R8 to R15. Those are where the integers are stored. That's your integer variables inside the processor. There are some other registers, the XMM registers, or YMM and ZMM, depending on which revision of the processor you've got. Any of your sort of floating point operations will happen in there, and any sort of packed operations will happen in those registers too. But by and large, and at least for this talk, I'm not going to talk about those registers. The only other thing you need to know is that there's an ABI. There's a way that functions talk to each other, and that's by convention. And that convention is that when I call a function, the arguments to that function will be an RDI, RSI, RDX, and then some other registers. And then if you're returning a value, an integer value that is, you're going to leave it in RAX. And there are rules about which registers you're allowed to overwrite and which registers you have to preserve. But if you're not writing assembly, you don't need to know. So that's kind of like our ABI for talking between functions. Now, registers, as I said, are 64-bit, but they have all these different names. So I've given RAX as an example here, but this is true also for RBX, RCX, all the other ones, and even R8 through R15. If we put an R at the beginning, we mean the whole 64 bits of the register. If we say EAX, we mean a 32-bit version of the register. And we just get the bottom 32 bits. And for complicated reasons, if you write to EAX, it zeroes out the top 32 bits. That's not true of AX, AH, and AL, which are these names for the bottom 16 bits and then the two bottom bytes, which are kind of legacy. I mean, this is kind of how Intel have maintained backwards compatibility back up to the, I think, the 8088, by having essentially just adding on these, widening the registers and giving them new names each time. Once you've got registers, you have to do things with them. So that's when we finally get to talk about instructions. So instructions can take anywhere between 0 and 3 operands. And unlike Chandler's talk, I'm using the Intel syntax here. So God, I had a whole routine done on for like tabs v spaces and things, but I didn't realize it was going to get that much of a clap. So yeah, by show of hands, who uses Intel syntax when they're looking at assembly? Okay. And who uses the AT&T syntax? Oh, good. I thought I was going to make some enemies today, but this is why Compiler Explorer has Intel assembly by default, because it makes sense. And because I grew up, and everyone else is wrong, I'm sorry. Because I grew up, again, with ARM and 6502, and they all have like the destination on the left-hand side. So if you see anything on my slides, the destination of the instruction is going to be the left-hand parameter. So operations can be things like call, return, add, subtract, exclusive OR, AND, or all those kind of bits and pieces. And then sort of uniquely to x86, well, not uniquely, specific to CISC-type machines like x86s, those destination and source and registers, things that are up there, don't have to be registers. They often are, but they can also be references to memory. And being as complicated as it is, the reference to memory can actually be more than just a memory address. We get this huge set of options at the bottom here. We get like a base, which is a constant. We can pick another register and say, add that register to it. And then we can also pick yet another register and add a multiple of 1, 2, 4, or 8 to it. Obviously, this is handy for things like arrays, because you want to have a pointer to the beginning of the array, and then you want to get like the ith element. You're going to put I in one of the registers, and then you're going to multiply it by 1, 2, 4, 8 to kind of move it forward that number of bytes. So that's really powerful. But it just sort of blurs the line about what a single instruction should be. I mean, if you can do all this on like an add. And in fact, this is the kind of thing we're talking about here. We've got a bunch of instructions there. I'll just put the C equivalent on the other side. You can kind of see the pattern there, I think. We're like, the first one is just reading from R14. It says R14 is an address, and I'm going to read 4 bytes from it and interpret it as an integer, put it into EAX. Second one is just adding 2 registers together. Then we can start to see these more sophisticated addressing modes where we can add whatever's at R14 plus a small constant into EAX. That would read out like the first element of an array if R14 was an integer array. And then that subtract sub EAX, D word pointer, blah, blah, blah. That is doing that array index operation that I was just saying about. Now, it turns out that the array indexing stuff is so powerful and so useful that there's an instruction that just says, hey, compute the address that I would otherwise want to read from and just give me the result of what that address computation is. That's that penultimate instruction there, the LEA, the load effective address. It's kind of a glorified add. It was designed to effectively do, like the C code equivalent shows, like take the address of some element in a subarray, but it's also effectively just adding a bunch of things together in a more sensible way, you might argue, than the actual add instruction. And then it's worth calling out this thing at the bottom here, that XOR EDX EDX. It seems kind of weird to exclusive OR something with itself. But as you've probably worked out, if you take any number and exclusive OR it with itself, you end up with 0. So this is a fancy way of setting EDX to 0. Why might you want to do it that way? Well, in order to encode a move instruction, move EAX, 0, you would need to put the instruction for move down, and then you'd have to put the 4 bytes that correspond to the 0 that came through. Whereas this exclusive OR is only 2 bytes to encode the opcode. So it's smaller and more compact in terms of code efficiency. There are also some architectural reasons inside which are super exciting and interesting, but I don't have time to go into here. But so in summary, funny 64-bit registers, they have different names. Parameters are passed in RDI and RSI first. Result comes out in racks. Operations are with the destination on the left-hand side, and destination and source can be registers or those memory thingies, memory references. Okay, so now you all know how to read x86 assembly. where were we? We were here, we were comparing these two implementations of effectively standard accumulate over a vector of ints. Which is better? Well, let's have a look at it. Let's have a look at the assembly. That's how we're going to do things. This is compiler explorer version 0.1. It's a shell command. So I was running G++ on a temp file, putting the optimizer on, telling it to just output the assembly instead of assembling it, outputting to dash, which is standard out, and of course the very important MASM equals Intel. Just pipe it through C++ filt because the mangled names don't mean anything to me. And then this funny grep here is just removing all of the funny lines, the dot directives that the compiler needs to put in order to talk to the assembler in order to get like a real program out, but I'm not interested in. And we got something like this. And I don't know if you know about the Unix watch command. It's a command that takes another command and it just sits there and runs it in a loop and it keeps running it over and over again. And you can even put dash dash diff and it will show you a difference from the previous time it ran. And so I just split my terminal in half with tmux, ran that in one side and ran vi on the other. And there you go, compiler explorer. So we found it so useful. We were able to answer all sorts of questions about how the code was being compiled. And once you've got a tool like this, you start thinking, oh, I wonder what else we could do. So I went home that night, and it was hurting me that this was a great solution, but it was not very pretty. And so what do you do when something doesn't look very pretty? You could use a cool graphical toolkit, right? Or you could go to the web. So, oh gosh, I'm so glad that loaded. This is Compiler Explorer. Many of you have seen it before. And this is the example. So this is the embedded view, but I'm not going to show the embedded view because, frankly, it is too small. Oh, I'm going to have to. All right, is that just about readable? Yeah, oh good, and the yellow shows up. Hooray. Okay, so here's our example. And on the left-hand side, we have the code. On the right-hand side, we have the assembly that comes from it. I'm compiling with GCC 7.1 here. It's the version I wrote this talk with, and I'm paranoid about changing anything in case it all moves around. Inside the compiler options here, I'm using O2 and C++1Z and Arch equals Haswell. Haswell is an Intel variant that's about 5 years old and is in most servers. It's a fairly safe baseline in my experience. Just to sort of give a brief sort of hand-wavy introduction, we're going to go into a little bit more detail in a second. If I mouse over this yellow area here, you can see that there are two yellow areas on the right-hand side that have sort of become a bit bolder, although it's difficult to see on that screen. The color coding tries to match up the source lines with the assembly output. So although we don't really know that much about assembly, apart from my crash course I've just given you, we can see that int result equals zero corresponds to ZOR EAX EAX. So we know that ZOR EAX EAX is the same as EAX equals zero, so we can at least sort of see a parallel between those two things. Similarly, if I look at this red block here, this is where we're accumulating into the result. Now again, because we saw it ZORing EAX with zero, we might reasonably intuit that the compiler is using EAX to hold the value of the result while it's running through its loop. And indeed, this is backed up by us looking at the add EAX, D word pointer RDX, which is it just saying, I'm going to accumulate into EAX with whatever is pointed at by RDX, and then it moves RDX on. And then you'll notice that this return result is white. There's no actual assembly instruction corresponding to it. That's because when the compiler has finished executing all this loop of adding things up, the result is already in EAX, which is where we needed to leave the return value for our caller. So there's actually no instruction. I mean, typically, I guess you could argue this ret here should be attributed to the result, but it's not perfect how these things are lined up. Okay, so before I get too far at this, I would just like to show you what happens if we turn the optimizer off. So optimizer off, and I'm not going to go through all this, but the compiler does pretty much exactly what we asked it. So this is kind of interesting and useful just to sort of see fully what it is that you have asked the compiler to do. And we can see that there's a whole bunch of code that's been generated here. These vector operations have been emitted. And if you went to the linker talk earlier today, you'll know that they were marked as weak and things like that. But on O1, yeah, we've got a MOV EAX comma zero here. It's funny that GCC has decided that just replacing MOV EAX comma zero with ZOR EAX EX is just not worth doing at O1. I don't know quite what the rationale is there. And then if you put it on O3, which is the one true setting, but not very good for, as we know, it's amazing. I mean, look at this stuff. pages of it, and I'm sure it's all super, super awesome, and it uses all these vector instructions, which are super cool and everything. But we'd have to benchmark to make sure that was actually faster than the simple version. I'd trust the compilers a lot, but anyway, it's too much to fit on a slide, so I'm kind of settling for O2 for most of this stuff. All right, anyway, what was our original question? It was, are we okay to do a range for? Now, I am going to drag down one of those, and I'm going to paste the code down here, and I'm going to hide away the hidden setup code that I've put there. Oh, the font size is slightly too big here, but I'm sure you'll give me the benefit of the doubt for a second. So I'm going to go for auto x in v result plus equals x, and I'm going to delete those two lines. And nothing's happened, because all I've done is I've created an editor window. The UI is such that I need to now actually slave a compiler to that window. So I'm going to pick up a compiler, and I'm going to put it over here. And then just to make it a fair fight, I am going to grab the same command line options and paste them in there. OK, well, I can scroll up and down and see that there's 14 instructions there, and there's 18 instructions there. But there's a better way to sort of see what's going on. I'm going to bring down a diff view, and I'm going to maximize it. All right, this is all good. There we go. All right, this is what I wanted to see. This is the two versions side by side with a difference. So you can see on the left-hand side is the version that is using the loop over from 0 to v.size and just accessing it by an index. And on the right-hand side is the version that's using the range for. Now again, with the caveat that you have to measure everything, you can't just look at these things, we can at least draw one thing, which is that although there's a bit of difference at the beginning, this region here from line 7 through 11, or 10 to 14, is identical on both sides. So even though we wrote the code in two completely different ways, the core loop, the bit that's actually running over everything and summing them up, is identical in both cases. And the difference in the top bit is of a couple of instructions. So we might reasonably expect them to perform very, very similarly. Oops, hang on a second. I was going to do one other thing. And that is for the purists among you that are saying, why didn't we use std accumulate? Accumulate, begin, v, end, v. Oh, typing under pressure is never easy. Ta-da! Now, if you were eagle-eyed, you'll spot that's absolutely identical, give or take one reordered instruction from the handwritten for loop. So use your standard algorithms, I think, is the takeaway there. Let's just quickly take apart that code. So this is an example of how, if I were reading some code, I would take it apart and try and intuit what's actually going on and why they're different at all. So if you remember, we're taking a vector of integers by reference. Now, there's no such thing as a reference in terms of the hardware. It's all pointers as far as the process is concerned. So effectively, what we've done is we've passed a pointer to a vector of integers to this function. The first parameter, the first and only parameter, will be in RDI. And you can see these first two instructions are reading from RDI and RDI plus 8. Now, it would be easy for you to sort of fall into the trap of thinking that RDI is pointing at the list of integers itself. It isn't. It's pointing at the vector. And in at least GCC's implementation of the STL, this is what ultimately, if you boil through all the template stuff, you get to. And that is, we've got a structure which has three pointers in it. The first pointer points to the beginning of the array. The second pointer points to the one past the end of the array. And the third pointer points to the end of the allocated region of storage for that particular array, sorry, vector, I'm saying. So that means that we can have more space than we're actually using, and as you know, vectors will grow to fill the amount of space that they need, and they will shrink down. Well, they won't shrink down unless you ask them to. Sorry, I'm getting carried away here. But the interesting thing here is that the size itself is not encoded inside that structure. We just have two pointers. This will become interesting. So here is the difference bit. The difference bit? Here are the bits that's different. On the left-hand side, we've got the traditional range-based, the traditional counting-based approach, and on the right-hand, we've got the range-based approach. Those first three instructions on the traditional side, the sub, the mov, and the shift right, are effectively taking the end pointer and subtracting it from the begin. That tells us how many bytes are there between the beginning and the end of our vector. And then that shift right by 2 is dividing it down by 4. You know, if you shift anything right, you're going to be dividing by 2, and if you shift right twice, you get a divide by 4. So what we've effectively done there is that's the size call. So the size call's been made, and we now know how many elements there are in our vector that we're going to be iterating over. Implicit in that shift right is a sort of comparison with 0. So if we got a 0 result, the equal flag flag will be set, and that JE, jump if equal, will disappear off to L4, which is the there was nothing to do, just return zero part of the program. So far we've said, is size equal to zero? If so, we're done. Great. So now we might reasonably expect it to use that while it counts up until it hits the end of the, like counts an it loop iterator until it hits that size. But something as interesting has happened here. The compiler has realized that we never used that index inside the loop, and that we're just reading an array one after another, and it's basically gone in and rewritten the whole thing for us in terms of generating a pointer to the end of the array and then walking a pointer forward through the whole array. So it now needs to know where the end of the array is, which we all know is actually in, or was in, RCX at the beginning. Compiler has unfortunately not noticed that, and so it's had to add RDX back into RCX in order to reconstitute the end pointer it had to start with. Unfortunate. And then it sets the result to zero there. So a little bit of extra work's happened here, and I think, I mean, there are probably some compiler writers here. You could probably, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to think that that could be optimized by the compiler. I don't know if there's anything. Oh, there's a note there, Piotr. Oh, okay. So I think the comment was that Clang was giving the same output, but it might be actually a bug. Is that right?
No, Clang was doing the same output for those two cases.
I see. Okay, it's difficult to communicate, so, the comment was that there was an issue with the way, or there may be an issue with the way Clang is. If we could talk about it at the end, perhaps that would be clarified, because otherwise we're going to be derailed forever here. But that's great. There are compiler people here. They can help me make this better. On the range side, of course, what's really happening is that range 4 is being rewritten to be get the begin, get the end, make an iterator, and walk it from begin to end. And so that's exactly what the compiler's done. So there's no funny working out how many iterations we need to do and then effectively throwing away the number of iterations there. The loop we already saw was identical in both cases, so I don't think I need to go into too much detail. We're just reading each integer one at a time and adding them to the accumulator, and then when the iterator hits the end, we stop looping around and we just hit that return instruction. So I think we can probably conclude that, give or take a couple of instructions right at the beginning, they're identical, which is great, really, because that means that we can say to everyone, go ahead, use the much better C++ idiom of range 4 rather than counting. That's excellent. Also, we learned that the optimizer settings make a huge difference. And in fairness, I haven't actually compiled the two versions with O3 and spent any time working out whether or not there's some other thing that changes if we try counting versus the range thing. I'm not sure that we would, but it would definitely be worth checking. And of course, you would benchmark it if it really mattered to you. And we saw that standard accumulate is identical, so we should really just be using standard accumulate. Okay, so that's an example of the kind of things you can do if you start sitting down and looking at code, and as I say, you start discovering these amazing things the compiler does for you. So the first thing I'm going to talk to you about is multiplication. Again, as I said at the beginning, these are all slide examples, so they're all necessarily very small and very simple, but they're pretty cool. So this is what a multiply x by y routine looks like. Pass in two things, x and y. EDI will have the first parameter, ESI will have the second parameter, and we need to get the multiplied version into EAX out. And this is what the compiler emits. That's cool. But can we do better than that? Multiplication, if you remember from grade school, looks something like this. This is a 4-bit multiply done by hand. I'm sure there are much cleverer things that go on inside the processor, but ultimately there's a lot of adds happening, and this is only a 4-bit multiply, so there's going to be 4 adds in the middle. So on a Haswell, where you're going to be running at least a 32-bit multiply most of the time, it's a miracle that they can get that to happen in 4 CPU cycles. Now, a CPU cycle is roughly a third of a nanosecond, so just get that into your head, right? We're still talking about something which doesn't take much more than a nanosecond, so it's crazy. But an add is one cycle. So maybe there's a faster way of doing this. Or maybe my clicker will work. There we are. What happens if we happen to know that we're multiplying by a constant? We know it happens all the time. You might be walking an array or getting the ith element of an array, and you need to be able to multiply by the size of the object. We might reasonably expect it to use that shift. There's a shifter where we can shift up by a power of 2. Sorry, shift up and therefore multiply by a power of 2. So we might expect it would shift it up by 1. Let's check. Oh, no shift. It's that funny LEA instruction. Like I said, it's a glorified add. You have to think of it as an add. But the cool thing about LEA is that you can have a different destination from the source, whereas the shift on x86 is in place. So it's avoided an instruction here just to move things around into the right place, and instead it said, OK, add RDI to RDI, great, and then put the result in EAX. We're done. Brilliant. What about some other numbers? Surely it's going to need a shift if we make it 4. Well, no, because we can use the LEA again. All right, well, now we know that the LEA instruction can do 1, 2, 4, or 8. So there'll be no surprises in store for us here, and there actually aren't. If we go to 16, we're going to see it using those shifts. And there you can see the two instructions that it would otherwise had to have used if it was just using shifts alone. Now, again, for anyone who's at Chandler's talk, you can see how clever the processor is at moving things around and reordering them. It's very, very clever, but it's still worth it to not have two instructions through your pipeline. But what happens if we do something like that? Okay, it's given up on us. So there's obviously a limitation in the compiler. Compiler writers are not as clever as they make out. I know that I can build that multiply myself. I know that 65,599 is 65,536 plus 64 minus 1, right? So that kind of, I can build it out of those operations. So I'm going to do that. And I'm going to make better code than the compiler. I know best. Oh. Ah. Well, that's awkward. So yeah, it turns out the compiler is smarter than me. No surprise there. So not only is it smart enough to know that the multiply is faster than all the shifts and adds and subtracts that it would otherwise have to do, it has worked out that my sequence of shifts and adds is actually equivalent to a multiply, and it said, well, I'm going to save you from yourself here. That, of course, is only true on more modern processors. So if we go back to the golden age, let's go i486. Yeah, you see? I am still channeling Michael Abrash's big book of awesome optimizations, and I can still write better code than the compiler. Well, no, still. If I turn this into the multiply that it really should have been all along, the compiler is actually even smarter than that sequence of instructions. Like, I have no idea what it's doing now. I haven't bothered to work it out. So the thing, the answer really is let the compiler do the things for you. It's going to be smarter than you. And I guess there's a sort of secondary thing there, is like telling it what architecture you're targeting is probably important as well. I mean, I don't think multiplies have been that slow for a long time, so I think you're safe on this particular one, but always take a look. All right. That's multiplication, and multiplication with a constant as well, so it's a bit of a special case. What about division? If you hated doing long multiplication as a kid, you probably, like me, loathe doing long division, and processors don't like it any much more than you. So this is the code that comes out if you do a divide or a modulus. It turns out that a circuitry that they use to make a divide also gives you the remainder at the same time. So the only difference between these two routines is whether or not it picks to return EAX or EDX. This is one of those funny cases where the instruction, the IDIV instruction, effectively outputs to two registers that aren't even named in the instruction. It's crazy. Anyway, a 32-bit divide on a Haswell takes 22 to 29 cycles. That's eternity. I mean, it's still only 10 nanoseconds, okay, but it's eternity compared to all those MOVs. The other thing that I haven't put up on the slide here is that there is only one divider for each core on your Intel chip. And it's not even fully pipelined. So those multiplies, there might be multiple multipliers on the chip, which means you can have multiple concurrent multipliers going on. They're also pipelined, which means that you can start a new multiply every cycle and get the result 4 cycles later. But at least if you have a chain of them going that aren't dependent, you can kind of get one multiply result every cycle. The divider, no chance. The divider, it's wedged, you're going to be waiting for 20 to 30 cycles before you get the result out, and no one else can use it. So, can we do better? Click. There we go. Well, obviously, trivially, if we divide by a constant, and that constant is a power of 2, we're back into shift land, right? So, I have moved over to using unsigned numbers here just to avoid extra code, but you can do this trick with signed numbers too. So, now there is no magic LEA instruction type trick to save us here. It's just going to do the shift which is cool. And you can't even see the code because I scaled everything up to try and let you see it. Okay. So there it is, x over 2. We're just shifting right. And you know, no surprise, I will do x times x divided by 16. It's going to shift it times by 4, and so on and so forth. But how often, I mean, in fairness, how often do you do integer division? But how often do you do integer division by a power of 2? Not that often, I'm guessing. So let's try 3. What happens here? Ah, we've lost a divide. There's still no divide on the right-hand side. We've got some mobs and things with a funny, scary-looking constant and a multiply. What's going on here? Well, compiler cleverness again. What's happening is that AAAAAB value is actually 2/3 shifted up into the sort of by 2 to the 32. So like effectively a fixed point 2/3 where the fixed point dot is between 32 and a lower 32. So it's 32.32. So if we multiply by it, we get the answer out shifted up by 32 bits. And then if we just discard the bottom bits here, which is what that mov ex is doing, then what we've got is the answer with a fixed point multiplied by 2/3. And then we halve it. So why are we multiplying by 2/3? Well, it turns out that in order to cover the entire range of an integer, an unsigned integer at least, there's just one fewer bit to do it by a third directly. You have to do it by 2/3 and then shift it down. And there are some very well-published algorithms for determining the exact sequence of operations you need to do in order to cover a particular range of values in a particular way. And I saw some copies of was it bit hacks or whatever. There's a book. I saw some outside in the library earlier. Oh, that's great. Sorry, cancel. I've been clicking report problem, but nothing seems to happen. So anyway, that's division. So if we've done division, we ought to look at what modulus does. And modulus is effectively just a divide, so that the bit that's grayed out at the top there. It's a bit that's, we do the divide, and then we just multiply it back up again by 3, and you'll see it's using the LEA instruction here to multiply by 3 by adding it to itself times 2. It's quite clever. And then it's subtracting it from the original number, and you get the remainder. So why am I banging on about moduli, moduluses, modulant? Well, they're used in hash maps, which is everyone's favorite container, right? So if you've got a hash value, you've probably got a 64-bit number that's come out of you like doing whatever crazy operation on your string. And now you've got your 1,021 buckets in your hash tree that you need to, your hash list that you need to start indexing from to look for the result. And the only way to kind of take your 64-bit value and smush it into the number of buckets you have is to modulus by the number of buckets, which is great, but we've just seen it's about the slowest thing you can do. Now, obviously, if you know ahead of time that your container is always going to have exactly 1,021 buckets, then you can write the code that does mod 1021. Compiler jumps in and goes, ah, modulus by a constant, I'll generate that cool code for you, and you're done. But of course, most of the time in general purpose code, we don't know how big our sets and maps and are going to be, our unordered ones anyway. And so there's going to be a dynamic number of how many buckets I currently have, and that's just going to mean there's going to be a divide in there. And that's unfortunate because hash maps are meant to be the fast thing. Again, we're only talking about 10 nanoseconds, but these things do make a difference. In fact, so much of a difference that libc++, after a certain point, gives up using prime numbers, which is like the good way of doing the number of buckets that you've got, and it starts using powers of 2, even though that's not actually like perfect, but for a sufficiently large number of buckets, it's probably okay. And at that point, then, it just uses an AND trick to pick the bottom few bits rather than going into a divide. So obviously, people are thinking about this. Some smart people, some people are looking at me and nodding at the moment, so I'm assuming it's them. Some people are thinking about this kind of stuff. And in the case of, say, boost multi-index, there is an even cleverer thing where they have like a certain set of allowable sizes of the buckets. So they just know that like we have 20 different possible sizes of the index, each of which is a prime number. And then instead of just modulusing by the actual size, they do a switch statement on how big is it at the moment. And they have case 1021, return hash mod 1021, or the equivalent. I think it's done by an ordinal value, but which means that yes, you've got a big switch statement, and yes, the compiler is going to have to dispatch and jump to the right part, but when you get there, you're just going to do a couple of adds and a multiply. So it's obviously worth thinking about. People cleverer than me are thinking about this anyway. And that actually is relying on the fact that the compiler is going to do this optimization for them, right? You wouldn't write it that way if you didn't know that that's what was going to happen. Who went to Phil Nash's talk earlier? There's a few. Cool. I thought he was going to steal my thunder on this part. So there are a number of data structures for which it is convenient to be able to count the number of set bits in an integer. Now, who has ever actually had to do that? Actually a lot more than I thought. I mean, Phil's hands up, of course, but that's surprising. I thought I was going to give this sort of example that everyone would look blankly at me like, why would we do that? But anyway, so this is a way to count the number of set bits. We're going to pass in a number of, we're going to pass in a value A, and we'll say, while there are still bits in A, increment the count, and then that funny A and equals A minus 1 is like one of the oldest bit twiddling tricks in the world for clearing the bottom set bit. Go around again. Once we've got no bits left, we're done. We return the count. Let's see what our compiler does with this. So this is GCC. GCC has done something quite clever here. It has got a loop. You can sort of see the yellow bit is the loop bit there. And then the red line there, the A and equals A minus 1, it's replaced with a BLSR instruction. I'd never seen the BLRS instruction before until I actually prepared for this talk. And it turns out it's custom made for doing this operation. It clears the bottom set bit and lets you kind of put it into another register. So there it's just, you know, clearing the bottom set bit. That's pretty cool. So it's picked an instruction which does exactly what I want. That's super clever. Can we do better than that, though? I imagine there's some people stroking their chin at the moment. Oh, yeah, we can do much better. So, turns out there is an x86 instruction whose only reason to be is to count the number of set bits. It's so common that people wanted it that Intel put it into the instruction set. Now, just have a think about what Clang must have done here. Like, there's no bearing on the right-hand side. There's no hint there that says, I am counting the number of set bits. There are some built-in pop count things that you can do, which tell the compiler, I wish to do this, and therefore the intrinsic will let you either emit the code that does this or the instruction if it's supported on the architecture I've picked. But I was blown away when this happened. This was amazing. So all the bits of code that I have that actually use the pop count instruction can be replaced with the much, much more readable human, well, I guess it depends on how you are, bit manipulation stuff, but you know, more readable to me, sensible straight line code. That's an awesome achievement. The last one I want to talk about is, again, a bit of a toy example. So standard caveats apply. And that is this summation. And I've written a routine here, and I've used const expert because I realized that this is all C so far, and that makes it C++, right? So we're going to sum up to the value x. And so we're just going to do the obvious thing of starting at 0, counting up to it, and adding it to our sum. Brilliant. And then we're going to write a little main routine that's going to sum up to 20. And so we're going to have a look at what the compiler does. How does it do? Right. OK. Well, it's const expert, right? Const expert means it can only possibly happen in the compiler, right? Well, I'm not using it in a const expert context, as it turns out. But let's just replace it with static instead. Or let's replace it with an error. Why don't we do that? We make it, it's still the same, right? So the compiler can see it. The compiler knows the game we're up to. And it says, I'm going to spend some time just working out if it boils down to a number. Now, this is a stupidly trivial example of this. In general, you might find this happens in code snippets that you're pasting into your into Compiler Explorer. And the trick with this is to make sure it depends on something the compiler doesn't know. So in this case, the compiler doesn't know how many arguments we're passing into the function. So there we are. Now we can actually see the loop in its glory. And again, GCC's done a cool thing. It's unrolled. No, it hasn't. I tell a lie. Sorry, that's the next bit. Ha ha. OK, so it's a pretty straightforward thing here. I'm not going to bore you by going through it, but you can see the shape of it. And you know, if we want to really go to town, we can turn on AO3 again. You can see, look at how cool. Again, I love all this stuff. I mean, I'm sure, I don't know how many command line arguments I need to pass before that's more efficient than the than the previous version. I don't know. But let's have a look at what Clang does again. Oh, that's interesting. There's no loop. There's a test in that blue region. And that test is just saying if it's less than or equal to 0, then the answer's 0. And then that yellow block, which apparently corresponds to sum plus equals I, don't know how the compiler came to that conclusion, but is just a move, a funny LEA, and a multiply. What's going on there? Well, as most of you probably know, there is a closed form solution to summation. Clang has worked out again what I'm doing, and it's replaced a code with a closed form solution. Yeah, that's pretty awesome, right? Even more interestingly, it hasn't actually used the thing that I always use, the xx plus 1 over 2. it has, in fact, replaced it with x plus x minus 1 over 2. Right? They're equivalent. The reason being is that what happens if we passed in int max? Right? It would have worked. The loop version would have worked for int max, but it wouldn't have worked if we had to do x plus 1. We would have overflowed. It would have all gone horribly wrong. I mean, how you'd get int max command line arguments onto a function is another problem. But, you know, essentially they've dealt with the overflow case as well. And it turns out you can tinker with that code quite a bit and it will, like, move things around and ultimately just give you a closed form solution every time. Just think about what that's doing. It's taken an order n piece of code I wrote and turned it into a constant time operation. There's another hand gone up here. Hi. Right, so the observation was that overflowing an integer is an undefined operation, and so why should it compile? It's because the compiler isn't allowed to start doing undefined behavior on my behalf. My x wasn't overflowing. Yeah, so it can't add 1 to x ever, because for all it knows, the value was actually int max beforehand. And nowhere in my code did it overflow the integer. So it can't introduce undefined behavior. We can talk about it afterwards. Anyway. Okay, these are dumb examples. They're all C examples. The compiler does so much more than this. I tried to get a slide together to explain some of my favorite things. I'm an old school, sort of OO, unfashionable kind of a guy, so I still use the keyword virtual. I'm a bad person, I know, but compilers are getting much better at seeing through that too. They can do static devirtualization in a lot of cases where they can prove that a type is of a particular type and they can get rid of the virtual function call overhead. And now they're getting cleverer and cleverer at, like, saying, I've looked at your entire program because of LTO, and I've seen that there is exactly one implementation of this interface, and so I'm going to assume that every call to that interface is to that particular implementation. It still has to check, so it does a quick check on the vtable pointer or the actual address of the function it's going to call to, in case you've DL opened something and loaded another implementation. But ultimately, it's effectively inlining the code and put a big check at the front. And that's pretty cool, but again, didn't fit on there. And of course, the compiler's doing range analysis, and it's doing constant propagation, and it's doing things I don't understand. I'm not a compiler writer. I'm just the guy at the other end of the pipeline looking up in awe and wonder, going, wow, that's so clever. And I think back to that 20-something me who always thought that the C compiler was basically a glorified macro assembler, and now I just realize how wrong I was. So the compiler has done an awful lot for you. You should really be thankful for the hard work that compiler writers put into making the code efficient, and most often correct, too. All right, so that's my big sort of love story of compiler writers, for compiler writers. And now I'm going to give you a little bit about how Compiler Explorer, I nearly said GCC Explorer again, gosh, a Compiler Explorer works. So this is the second talk at this conference where I'm going to talk about JavaScript. I feel so bad. So, yeah, it's written in Node.js, which is a common JavaScript framework. And I know we sometimes give C++ a bit of a bad rap for having funny defaults and weird, odd edge cases, but if just take a look at JavaScript, really. I mean, honestly, you can just Google for it and you'll find three cases at least that will make you just, I don't know, give up on the whole thing. But it's ubiquitous. It's easy to start and get up and running quickly, and once you start a project and it becomes really successful, it's kind of hard for you to, like, go, oh, I should really rewrite this in something else. And the irony is, the only other sort of big open source library that I have, big is relative, is a web server written in C++, so you'd think I would have used that, but never mind. So it runs on Amazon's infrastructure. Oh, this is what Node.js looks like. It's horrible, but, you know, this is not that much more code, gives you a very primitive version of Compiler Explorer. You just say, hey, I'm going to get some requests being posted to me at this URL, feed them to the compiler, see what it comes out with, maybe do a bit of primitive text processing, and then give it back. So straightforward. And I wish it was as easy to do some things like that in C++. And I'm sure there are people in this room who can tell me the libraries that I should be using to make it that easy. Behind the scenes, it all runs on Amazon's infrastructure. That means EC2, which is their Elastic Compute Cloud. I have an edge cache. Oh, first, it's worth saying that it started out as, like, on the free tier, like, so literally, like, the world's smallest computer that Amazon would give me for a year for free. And as demand increased, it got more and more sophisticated, which is to say that the onion layers have grown and grown around it, and now it's just a bit of a DevOps nightmare. But anyway, it's now fully cached at the edge, so hopefully when you load the page, it comes up pretty quickly. There's a load balancer behind the Edge cache. So when you actually make your post, it gets fed out to one of the many instances that I have in the background. Those instances are VMs that are running Ubuntu. And within those VMs, as I told you, it's onion layers, there are Docker images. So Docker is this sort of very lightweight container thing which allows you to bundle together data and sort of run a process in a namespace, which means it can only see a subset of the computer. So it's a bit like a VM within a VM, although much lighter weight. That gives me a certain amount of protection from all the crazy code you guys put in the site, not taking down the whole thing. And it also gives me a way of like making sure I can run the exact binaries locally that are going to be deployed to the site. So most of the time, I don't break it when I update the site. And for a long time, I used to build all of the compiler images actually into those Docker images. And that started getting less fun when you get 40 or 50 gigabytes worth of compilers, and you try and build a node, a Docker image for it, and then you have to try and push it to all of the nodes. And you know, it takes like 10 or 15 minutes for a node to start up because it has to pull down all this data before it can even start. So I solved it with the cheesiest hack in the world, and that is I just have a big NFS mount that everything stands on. So it seems to work. The compilers themselves, as I say, initially I started out by apt-get installing them. So the Docker images kind of look like little VMs, and so you would shell into them, and then I'd have all these commands that would like sudo apt-get install gcc dash blah, 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 or whatever. That was great. It was very convenient. But then I was finding that the compilers that I'd originally put on the site for like Ubuntu 11 were being deprecated, and they wouldn't install on GCC 12 or 14 or 16. So I was keeping a container around just because it had some ancient compiler that I wanted to keep. And I want to make sure that the URLs that you guys are sharing around are always going to work, which is a whole other story. You know, URLs are forever. Forget like any kind of radiation thing. It's like URLs stick around absolutely forever. So they're built through, now they're built through these Docker images. I spent quite a bunch of time trying to learn good practices for building compilers. And so I've kind of canonified that. It's all on my website, which I should link towards the end. And they're built in Docker images just because then I have reproducible builds, which is something I'm very passionate about. I want anyone else to be able to clone this down and be able to build the same compiler that Compiler Explorer is using. And more to the point, actually, once I've built them, I chuck them on S3, and they're marked public. And I keep getting emails from Amazon because there have been a lot of people recently who've discovered that they have public information on S3, and they didn't mean to. Well, I actually mean to. The reason that they're public is that you can actually run a shell script, and if you have enough hard disk space, you're going to get 40 gigs worth of open source compilers dumped onto your hard disk, which is cool, because then you can run your own local instance of Compiler Explorer if you don't want to ship your code to me, for example. Now, that's the open source ones. Very kindly, Intel have provided me with licenses as well for ICC, and they're somewhere else. And the Microsoft compilers also currently run via Wine, which is a bit of an admission of my lack of understanding of how to administrate Windows more than anything else. So I'm glad to say I've met up with Andrew and some of the other Microsoft folks who are going to help me, and we're hoping to get some proper support for the Windows compilers into Compiler Explorer soon. So that's a really exciting thing that's coming up. Oh. Thank them. And, you know, security. Well, I only got an email this morning, actually, from someone who thinks they've hacked my site. And maybe they have. I don't know. Turns out a compiler is a gigantic security hole waiting to happen. It's a huge attack vector. Compiler writers are awesome, as I think I've already said enough times. They're not really security experts, and they don't have to be, right? They're on a trusted system. But I had no idea how many ways there were to inject code into a compiler. You know, you think a compiler just builds the code. I'm not actually executing it, right? But GCC has a plugin architecture. You can supply -f plugin and point it at something which is a load as a dynamic library. So if you can cause the compiler to crash, but having written the file somewhere, and then my cleanup code doesn't work immediately, then you might be able to guess the path of it, and then do another compile with -f plugin equals blue, and then you're in. Only happened once. Also behind the scenes, GCC uses something called specs files, which I don't claim to understand, but seems to be part of the processes, the many, many pipelined processes that comprise a compilation, you know, from the preprocessor through CC1+, through the AS assembler, and all that kind of stuff. And essentially, it's a set of shell commands to run. And of course, you can say, actually, I'd like you to use my specs file over here. And again, you're back in the same world, where as long as you can write a file somewhere on the disk that says run I don't know, Netcat or something, then, you know, you're in. Now, I sort of started down a route of trying to harden everything, and then eventually I came to the conclusion that there's just no way I can make it completely bulletproof, and so I've accepted that the principle of what's the worst that can happen, it should apply, and that is, you could hack one of my nodes, and you can take down the Docker instance, and even if you don't get out of the Docker container, the worst you can do is stop it from running, and then something else will come and kill the process, and it'll start up again. So hopefully that's not too bad. Even if you escape the Docker sort of ch root and namespace jail, which I'm told is possible, you're in a VM which has no privileges to anything. I'm saying this aware that it's being recorded, and someone's going to email me and say, oh, this is not actually true, but oh well. Anyway, so Docker protects me in some ways from this. And I experimented for a long time using LD preload tricks, which is a Unix-specific thing where you can force a dynamic library to be loaded before an executable is run, and then you can replace some of the system routines. So I have a little bit of code that basically replaces open and read and all that kind of stuff, and just has a blacklist and whitelist of all the different files that you that I was allowing the compiler to read, and that was my way of preventing from people from doing like hash include slash etc. password, ha ha ha, which is essentially the kind of thing that people try first. Turns out, though, the compiler needs to read etc. password because it wants to know which user's running it. And I thought, well, okay, well, we'll allow that. And then it was, now it's trying to read proc CPU info. I'm like, well, that's a bit dodgy. Why should I let it read the proc file system? And it's like, well, because people want to type march equals native, and how else is the compiler going to find out what CPU it's running on? And so on and so forth. And before I knew it, everything was basically fair game for the compiler. I just threw my hands up and said, well, sod it. So I guess we should talk a little bit about that front end, the bit you see. So another huge props to Microsoft here. VisualStudio.code's editor is a separate project that you can, written in JavaScript, that you can just take and plonk into your project. And it's awesome. It's a fully featured editor. And it does everything I'd ever want. That diff view, for example, that diff view is just a native thing that Monaco can do. It had been long been on my backlog to have a diff. I think it was like bug number 3. And then when I moved over to Monaco from CodeMirror, which was the previous JavaScript library I was using, it had this diff feature. I was like, oh, that's cool. And it was just 2 lines of code to enable it. It was awesome. And then the funny sort of drag and drop thing that I see other people wrestling with, which is more of a testament to how rubbish I am at user experience design, is golden layout. And I'd like to thanks to both the teams behind those things. It's awesome that they've made open sourced those things that made it very easy to sort of like copy paste the website together. And clicker. So the code's on GitHub. There are 2 repositories. The first one has all of the node code and all of the front end code. So effectively, if you have node on your machine, you should be able to git clone that and type make, and then you're done. You'll have your own local running version of Compiler Explorer. The second line there is the image, which has all of the Amazon stuff, it has all of the Docker container stuff, it has all of the compiler scripts, it has everything. So basically, if I were to be knocked over by a bus tomorrow, you should be able to reconstitute Compiler Explorer with what's there. And if you were, I've done that one. And there will be more about this running in the next C++ Weekly, Jason's weekly YouTube thingamajig. And so this is a slide I plonked in earlier, so I haven't really thought about what I'm going to say, but this is inspired by the conversations I've had with you folks. And that is, I think you've got a flavor for how I use Compiler Explorer, why it was made, and I've been surprised at how differently everyone else seems to use it. There are a few people who like to show cool and cute optimizations the compiler does, but it has become this sort of de facto code paste bin. I think Jason alluded to that in the introduction, saying that it's how we share stuff now, which is hugely exciting for me. And I know that some of the compiler teams are using it internally to test out things that they're doing, and I did a search on both the Clang and the GCC bug forums, and there are over 100 bugs that have citations to Compiler Explorer links, and people use it to like sort of bisect quickly. You can just the drop down has like so many compilers, you just kind of flick up and down and go, it was introduced in 6.2, and that's great. I've also seen people or heard of people using it as a kind of REPL, which, if you're doing a bit of template metaprogramming, you can write tests, you can write const expert code that uses it, or static asserts, and you can start like noodling and typing code. And I think this sort of shows the deficiency in our tooling, that It's a nicer experience to type into a website which posts your code across the internet to someone else's machine to build it and sends it back than it is to just do it locally. So I wonder if our tools per persons in the audience might have some ideas from that. And I've also seen people using it as a training resource, which is also really rewarding. You know, to Bjarne's point in the opening keynote, you know, teaching C++ and making sure people understand how to write this code and understanding the processes that we go through when we write code is important. And it's nice that I feel it can Compiler Explorer can help with that. Quick sneak peek. I always get those the wrong way around. Of things that are coming soon. There is a CFG, that is a control flow graph viewer, coming very, very soon. In fact, it's on the beta site. So if you go to godbolt.org/beta, then you'll see that there is a new icon on the far right-hand side of the assembly pane. You can click and drag, and you get like a view that shows all how the different basic blocks interact. I'm also looking to unify all the languages. So you've noticed that it's inappropriately, as many people have said, called gcc.godbolt.org. It should just be godbolt.org. Well, it should really just be compilerexplorer.com, but you know, no one's going to let me get away with renaming it now. So I'd like to have all the different languages. You know, there are other languages supported. D, there is Haskell, there's Swift, there's ISPC. They're all there, and it would be nice to have them all in one place. So instead of hitting different URLs, you could actually bring up two different editors from two different languages, write the Go version and the C version of something, and then see how the assembly works out side by side. I fear that will lead to some flame wars, so I'm not taking any responsibility for that. And then the one thing everybody always asks me about is executing the code. I mean, it's fair to say there are other online compilers out there, and they are very good, and you should check them out as well. There's OneBox and other ones that escape my mind right now. But some of those have execution support, and that's awesome because it's nice to write the code. It's even better if you can see what it actually does. But you've seen my amateur hour DevOps and security setup, so I've really got to get my head around that before I allow arbitrary code to be run. But it is coming soon, and I'm taking advice from people who know much more about this than me. Okay. We're at the end now, and I just want to say thanks. This is not just me. Compiler Explorer is now, I'm glad to say, getting a lot of contributions from external people. So Ruben, Gabriel, Simon Brand, Johan, Jared, JD, and the other people that have both filed issues or taken the time to contact me directly and tell me about issues that they've found or have suggestions for the site. And you know, it's awesome. It's lovely to have something that has been a labor of love that you just were scratching your own itch and then find that actually it's useful for other people. And not only that they're willing to help you with it. Thanks also to the Patreon folks who help pay the bill. I'm in the embarrassing situation of actually making a small amount of money at the moment out of this, which is awkward. So I keep upping the number of instances just to counteract it. So if you put more money in, you'll get faster compiles. Thanks to the awesome C++ community. Oops, there we go, spoiled the ending. Thanks to the awesome C++ community, like the folks on Slack, have been a great source of inspiration and idea bouncing. And of course, thanks to you for sitting through while I talk about my funny little website. Go and read some assembly. Thank you. Thank you. We've got time for some questions until I'm told otherwise. So yeah, hi.
Can you go back to the slide where you showed the summation or the equation?
Oh, you're going to find a hole in my amateur maths, yeah. Somewhere in here. Hold up.
You'd think it would stick out like a sore thumb, right? There it is.
All right.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that actually, like the client transformed this to have this like x minus one, because it's worried about overflow, but the multiply can also overflow. Like because the whole thing cannot overflow,
right?
So, like if you look at the assembly, you'll see that it uses some very weird instructions, and actually in a compiler, it models it as a 33 bits.
Ah.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, there's somebody who actually knows what they're talking about.
Yeah, I hope that 15.6 MSVC will also have this.
I don't know. We've got some MSVC folks in here. Thank you. I guess on this side. Hi.
I actually had a question about scope. Other tools that I've used as like a pastebin for code provide external libraries like Boost or Ranges.
Mm-hmm.
Any plans, or is that even in scope for this
project? Let's have a look. Hang on. Just the other day, some kind soul. Oh, look. Thank you, Twitter. Oh, go away. Never do things live. Let's go to the live website. So we now have a relatively straightforward way of adding libraries in. And I'm glad to say Abseil is one of the most recent ones that we put in.
That is awesome.
So thank you, Google, for the heads up on that. Oh, thank you. I guess, hi.
Hey. OK, so you said you like people to use to share code, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any way of making links shorter? Like,
well, the link shortening, so I have a thing. At least at the moment, I'm not storing any data at all. I think that's, I should make that clear. Like, I don't care about your code. My life is far too complicated and short to read your code, so I don't do anything with it other than compile it and throw it away. And I don't even want to store it long term at the moment until I have like some privacy policy and things. So what actually happens is the URL has everything. So when we do the long URL, if I were to get a share here, you've seen it. It's like it's giant. So then I use Google's link shortener to turn it into the smaller version that it is. And I've
like
been
it fails
reliably.
At some point, right?
What's that, sorry?
It fails at some point.
Yes, it fails at 8,000 characters. So I'm going to have to pony up at some point and actually store your data, I think, in order to give you the sort of features that people are asking for. And we've got some ideas about how to do that and to do it in a way that means that your data is safe. And backed up, because I never want those URLs to go away. That's really important to me, that people can still go back to Stack Overflow 5 years ago and find some awesome reply to something and it still have it work.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Hi.
Regarding that optimization you were talking about with the hash table, where you have a set of fixed choices of the length
right,
of the hash
table. Right, the Boost multi-index one, yeah.
Yeah, and then you do a switch. Well, those possible fixed choices aren't right next to each other. They're all spread apart.
Right.
So you're going to wind up having to do a binary search, which is a whole bunch
right.
of ifs. So you stall the pipeline.
Yeah, I simplified for the purposes. What I believe it actually does is it just has the set of ordinal values. So say it has 20 different choices of size of buckets, and it switches between 0 and 20 then, and it knows that the ninth possible size of buckets is 1,021. I know I described it as case 1021, but it was actually like, it would be switch, case 9, return, hash, percent 1021. Does that make more sense?
Well, what I don't understand is if you have a bunch of cases that are really far apart, you can't have a jump.
Right, they wouldn't be far apart. As I say, they would just be numbers between 0 and, say, 20 as the 20 possible sizes. And then, of course, it just uses a jump table, and so you just jump to the right bit of code. Yeah, I oversimplified that. I was thinking otherwise I'd spend ages trying to explain it, and as you've probably realized, I'm not the best. I guess you were here first. Yeah, go.
Hi. Do you have any idea to support the execution? So I think if you support the WebAssembly, I think it can be supported.
That's right. So using WebAssembly, I mean, it's already been the case that people have asked me to put JavaScript backend support in so I can compile to JavaScript and web ASM.js, and then WebAssembly would be another thing. And so, yes, there is a potential for compiling to WebAssembly, shipping it back to the client and saying, well, you can play with it as much as you like. The only computer you're breaking is your own. That has a certain appeal to it, but there are many, many compilers here that don't have backends for WebAssembly. And so, I mean, I guess one thing I've thought about doing, I mean, if you came to my other talk, you know I'm sort of strangely passionate about emulating things. And if you've ever seen any of my YouTube videos, I also love talking about microarchitecture and how the internals of processes work. In my dream job, I would sit down and I would write a JavaScript emulator for the x86 with all the pipeline and everything, and then I could like complete the circle and have everything together, and then you could execute it locally and see how the caches work and everything. It would be awesome. But no, at the moment, I think execution will probably remain on the server side.
Okay, thank you.
I
have one.
Of course, go for it.
I just came here in a C++ conference, but most of my team members are working for the Linux kernel, and then. Do you have any idea to support the Linux kernel code?
So I would suggest that grab the code locally, point it at your own compiler. There are no restrictions on which files it can pick out when it's local. It's not running in a Docker container when you run it locally. So you can do -i and point it at user include Linux or wherever you'd like it to. And that's what I do. So when I'm using Compiler Explorer at work, I'll use it locally, and I'll do -i in my project path, and then I can just hash include, you know, my thing that I'm interested in looking at .h, and then write a little test function, I can see how the assembly is generated. So I think you could probably use the same approach there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I appreciate it if you don't want to get into this, but how much does this cost?
Oh, I don't mind telling you at all. I'm spending about $120 on Amazon costs just straight up, and then there's a just on like CPU like stuff, and then there's like transfer costs, and then there's the miscellany, the bill. But it's about $150 on that, and then there's a bunch of other things that I have like
$150 per
month. Sorry, $150 a month, and then there's a bunch of other stuff. It ends up being of around about $200 a month. And I dither on what I'm going to spend the surplus that I got. So my patrons are currently about 300, which is awesome. So I'm like net up, although if you account for the...
It's going to go up by 10 or something. Like it's going to keep going up.
I mean, maybe. Don't make it any more awkward than it is. So if people have got ideas about how to improve it that may involve larger sums of money rather than that, then I'm all ears for adding stuff that's a mouse click away particularly. So thank you. I guess now I've lost track of who was next. I'm going to just go alternating.
Do you think it's possible to support LVM intermediate representations?
Yes, absolutely.
I think because it will help LVM folks, especially for people who's ramping up on that to
Can anyone remember what it is? Emit LLV? Oh, well, there you are. That works, apparently. So it already... don't clap. Don't clap that. I can just put command line options in and it works. It just works, right? It looks... Yeah, so it's sort of supported only because it will just dump whatever the compiler gives me. I'm not being clever here. But we have got some... you can see there's a load of redness in here that isn't that great. We're going to be putting in, better support for syntax highlighting of LLVM. But you can do that already. And it would be nice to, filter it as well. So, it's gotten more and more sophisticated. The filtering that I do has gotten more and more sophisticated because I really just want to show the function that you're interested in and not all the fluff that comes in. And I don't know enough about LLVM intermediate representation to know how to do that, but I think it'll be something that'll be coming down the line.
Yeah, I think looks pretty cool.
It also supports minus E, which is pre-processing, is that, yeah? Which is how people do the horrible, include, we'll do it over here, hash includes password.h, whatever. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. All right, over this side now, hi.
I'll bring this comment only because you mentioned it. There is an x86, as far as I know, there is an x86 emulator in JavaScript.
Sweet.
You can look it up in Google. The one that I know is in billard.org, and it runs an entire Linux. It has a compiler. It runs everything.
That's awesome.
It's even somewhat fast.
Okay.
I don't know how. That guy's crazy.
That would be fun. Yeah, okay, thank you. That's a great steer. Thanks. I think last question, maybe the look of it.
How do you get the association from C++ lines to assembly lines?
Ah, magic. No, I just pass minus G. Whatever you type in, there's always a minus G in there. And luckily, the assembly output has the dot lock things that are the hint to the assembler to emit the dwarf debug, and I parse that out. I also support stabs because there's some ancient compilers that do that as well. But it's not that sophisticated. And I've filed a few bugs with both, I think, GCC and Clang about where they decide to plonk which line. Corresponds to what, because there's some obvious glaring ones. We're like, come on, guys. I'm sure you could attribute this to the right spot, but we'll see. Okay. I think we're done. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much.
Bash Films can shoot your event with multiple cameras, link to presentation slides, add titles, and edit your event live for a full broadcast experience.
How is this even working? So this is actually a more interesting program to look at in a lot of ways. So let's profile it. Give it a little bit of time to do a profile for us. Let's see exactly what it is that's making this faster or slower based on the different inputs. You can really gain a lot of insight by actually looking at the profile like this.
I worked at Sesame Street. I got brought on to be a writer's assistant on a show called Sesame Street English, which was to teach English to kids in China and Japan. It seems very simple, the shows that they put together, but it's actually really hard to design a show that is not only for young kids, but also the parents.
Confession like this is therapeutic. I hope you all get something out of this, but if you don't, the therapy will have been good for me, so thank you. 7 years ago, I wasn't working at Google, I was from my previous employer, which was a large multinational investment bank. I had what was up to that point the worst day of my career.
And then came the anger. Anger at ourselves because we knew we were responsible for America's first space disaster. We wrote two more words into our vocabulary as mission controllers, tough and competent. Tough meaning we will never again shirk from our responsibilities because we are forever accountable for what we do. Competent will never again take anything for granted. We will never stop learning. From now on, the teams in mission control will be perfect because as a team, we must never fail.
One other thing. We're all in a very fortunate position. We've been very lucky in our lives and so forth. And I think as part of the mission, it's also good sometimes to take that fortune and give back. To make sure that you take this platform and use it towards worthy causes. That's good karma. That's good stuff in the universe.
We understand that your event will have needs that are specific to your organization. Please email or call us directly to discuss your particular event. We look forward to discussing your goals and helping make your event a success.